morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, good morning.
And we're still talking about the fabulous time we had in both Charleston, South Carolina, and New York City. First up is actually one of our most favorite chefs in the whole entire world. We'll start with that.
We should start with a note of explanation, because we were in Charleston several weeks ago, as you know, and you listened to the program then. We had a technical difficulty with the interview with Mike Latta, the chef and co-owner of Fig Restaurant. So we re-recorded the interview with him, pretty covering what we hope was the same ground as before. We also met him in New York at the James Beard Awards, where he was nominated a second year in a row. And we commiserated with him because, unfortunately, someone else carried off the prize. But he deserves a prize. He's absolutely a terrific chef. And Food is Good is where you should go when you get to Charleston.
FIG is an acronym for Food is Good. And it's also one of the top restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to On the Menu, Mike Latta, who's the chef co-owner of this wonderful restaurant.
Well, thanks for having me, Ann.
Yes, and as I understand it, one of the biggest things that happened since we talked to you last year is that you celebrated your fifth anniversary.
That's correct. In the middle of April, we turned five, and we had a great celebration with some of our best customers and some of my friends in Charleston who also have restaurants cooked with me, and we had a great time.
Now, you were not a native son. In other words, you're not a good Southern boy. You are a...
Damn Yankee.
Yeah.
I'm from Massachusetts originally. I moved to the South, basically to Atlanta in 1993, and then to Charleston in 1998, where I've been for the last 10 years. So, no, I'm not a native, but whenever I go home, for some reason, my friends tell me I talk like a Southerner.
Oh, wow.
Maybe because I like to use the word y'all.
Now, you are a devotee of local seasonal produce, products, farmers, and a supporter of the slow food movement. How did you end up getting into that situation? What drove you in that direction?
Well, and I got a job in Atlanta at a restaurant called Ciboulette years ago in 1993, and very inspiring restaurant. The food was fantastic, and it was the most professional restaurant that I had been in at that point in my career. So I gave everything I had and worked, you know, for countless hours on my own time to learn all the food and the techniques and you know, everything about the kitchen. I wanted to be part of everything, including pastry. So about 6 or 8 months after that, my timing was perfect. The chef de cuisine had left, and the job was offered to me. And when I took the job, I realized that I had no formal training, and I was pretty new to the game, so I had to pick a direction, something that I thought meant I wanted to define my style, and I was looking and thinking, and I didn't know what exactly that really struck, I guess, struck a nerve with me. So but I did have a love for vegetables, so I decided to really develop and explore vegetable cookery. And I met some wonderful growers and became a big part of the farming community in Atlanta, you know, back in the mid-90s. And so professionally, I've always cooked that way. And now I don't know any other way to cook other than locally and seasonally. And I eventually came to Charleston to do that for another restaurant, and then eventually my own Fig.
Your own Fig. And you have talked to us about this great freedom you have with owning your own restaurant.
Well, I guess the freedoms that we've talked about are that I can change my menu whenever I'd like to. And some chefs don't have the ability to take some of the staples off the menu. Some chefs don't have the ability to don't have creative freedom over their own menus in the restaurants. And,
now you have an understanding partner too, though, Mike, right?
Oh yes. Well, my partner, you know, and I, we see eye to eye on so many things, which is why we're still partners after 5 years. But what we do is we stick to our guns. It's very easy to become a restaurant for everybody. And we've really tried to stick to our guns and, you know, change the menu when we, you know, when the food is not in season anymore. And sometimes it's difficult to explain to people why we don't do things the way we have for the last several weeks. You know, dishes that they've fallen in love with. And I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Dishes that we've fallen in love with, and the customers have fallen in love with, we have to take up the menu when the food is no longer, you know, fresh or available.
Now, you do have a couple of things you do all the time, though, things that you're sort of famous for, like the chicken pate and the beef tartare.
There are a couple of things on our menu that that don't change because we feel as though that they are staples to the menu. But what happens is those things are mostly protein-driven. And what we do is we change the accompaniments seasonally. So that chicken liver pate that we're talking about right now has pickled cherries on it today. And maybe in a few weeks or a month or so, it might have fresh sliced peaches or pickled peaches or some other, you know, seasonal accompaniment. Maybe
that's good.
Okra, something that's in season at the time.
Now, you have had a great deal of national attention and success focused on you. And your second Beard nomination for Best Chef Southeast. What do you think is generating this? Just sheer talent, or?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'd say that I think, as far as I can gather, the way that I look at the Beard Awards is I can only imagine that you have to meet certain criteria. And I think maybe the positive attention that's been given to Fig and myself. Is that we've done something in Charleston that wasn't done, you know, when we opened 5 years ago, we were the only restaurant totally dedicated to a seasonal menu. I say only. I'm sure there's definitely other chefs out there buying local and using tons of local product and things like that, but our restaurant was dedicated to it. So it stood out, and it was a clear message that was easily understood or conveyed, and I think people really attached themselves to it. And, you know, it was easy for us to be the go-to restaurant when, you know, the ever-growing concern or interest in local food, so the media would call us, and the local news people would ask us to do, you know, talks on the morning show about what it means to buy locally and seasonally, and so we just got a lot of attention that way, and I think it was kind of refreshing in our market to have a restaurant that was a more of a community restaurant in a tourist market. There's a lot of savvy people in Charleston that like to eat good wholesome food in a, you know, in a great restaurant setting, but there was very few places to do that. And I think Fig has just kind of fell into the right place at the right time. And I like to think that our service program has had a lot to do with it as well. We have a dedicated service staff that is truly interested in all the details of the cuisine.
They're really very sweet. I mean,
they're special people. And I think that can you put some of those elements together? We have an owner-operated environment, so there's always I think maybe that little bit extra that we can offer because of that. So it's an equation that, you know, I don't know if I can understand every bit of it, but I know that it's working for us, and I think people are really enjoying it.
The stone crab claw story that you told us when we were there, and the dish that you served is a really remarkable example of that. Do you want to just do that quickly for us?
Well, if I can, the story that I can only imagine that I would have told you is that was just in reference to the stone crab industry and how they're normally distributed to other restaurants.
Right,
that's right. You said
they're cooked on the boat.
You said most of it's already cooked, but I've got someone who when she gets them, she brings them to me uncooked.
I've never spent a day on a stone crab boat, but what I know is being true is that the crabs are cooked on the boat. So they're harvested.
But you're only talking about the claw. That's all. They have to pull off a claw and throw
it
back.
Well, yes, of course. Now, when you harvest a stone crab, you're only allowed to take one of the claws, and you have to throw the crab back in so it can live to grow another claw and to be harvested again or whatever. But the beauty of it here in Charleston, there's not a big commercial fishery. And we're fortunate to have a couple of people that we've been doing business with for many years who can find these little special things for us. And so she's started to go out and harvest stone crabs herself. And literally, we'll get phone calls from the boat saying, you know, how many pounds do you want? And if we say, you know, 20, and she's got 15, well, then she'll say, okay, well, let me go to my next trap, and let's see what I can get for you.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then she'll bring them to the restaurant. We have to cook them immediately because they can't be refrigerated, or the meat will stick to the shell. And then they're on the menu that night. And so you could not get a better experience, in my opinion.
Well, it was delicious. To give our listeners some idea of your style of cuisine, could you run through some of the other special dishes that you have in that tasting menu we did?
Well, what we do in the
radishes.
What we do is, you know, especially on a day-to-day basis, we change the menu to best reflect what's coming out of the ground or out of the water. or out of the fields, you know, day to day, week to week. And so I think that if we don't talk about that to our customers, I think they can kind of miss that point sometimes, depending on how well they know the restaurant. I think that when you get a plate of radishes like we served you with, some beautiful artisanal butter and Florida celery or sea salt, I think it's an incredibly simple dish, but it's very reflective of the seasons and something that you would not get in August or December in Fig. You know, maybe in the early fall and in the springtime, those are the things that you might have at Fig, and they come and go with the seasons. And I think that represents how we cook or approach our cuisine at the restaurant. Other things that we served you that day were you know, day boat snapper and day boat grouper, and we served them literally with vegetables that,
they
you know,
were like, wonderful.
That were just, and it's all very simple, as you know, but to make all that happen, you have to have a big network of growers. You have to be able to count on all the variables that come into play when you run such a seasonal menu. It's not uncommon for us to talk to a grower at 8 o'clock in the morning and they'll say, I've got as many filet beans as you could possibly, you know, possibly using your restaurant in a week's time. I said, well, pick me 25 pounds. At 3 o'clock when they show up, they said, oh, my labor quit on me today, so I wasn't able to get you any beans. So, you know, there's so many times, you know, we have to deal with a lot of variables, you know, and that's, you know, between nature and, you know, a frost overnight or something going to bolt. It's very inconsistent with what we can count on, so we have to have a you know, it's taken us a while to figure out how we can consistently put this food in the plate and deliver it to the customer. That's why our food's, you know, I think simple by design, but relatively ambitious in a busy restaurant setting.
Well, I think that it's simple, but simply delicious, too.
Yeah. Now let's pop a few parameters in here. The website is www.eatatfig.com. Food is good being the inspiration for the name, of course. Don't be misled, listeners. When you go to the street address, it looks like they're hiding.
Well, we're about to paint the building, so.
Oh, you kind of paint. I thought you were.
People say we should. Some people say we shouldn't.
Yeah, well, it doesn't look from the outside like it's like on the inside. The other recommendation I would have for you, because we were there, we were with you, I think, on a Tuesday evening, and on a Tuesday evening at prime dining time, the room was packed. So reservations are highly recommended. Can you make them online, Mike?
You can. We do have a link on our website that goes to a company called Open Table, where you're able to look for you know, certain, you know, availabilities and whatnot. But you know, it's always a good idea to make a phone call too, just to make sure that we have everything. But the Open Table system has worked out pretty well, so online is a fine way.
And you don't do lunch.
We do not do lunch.
Okay, and between now and when this interview will air on the program, an important event in your life will have happened. You will either be a two-time finalist for the James Beard Awards Best Chef Southeast, or you'll have a trophy in your case. And we're rooting for you. We'll be there. We'll be there in the press room waiting for you to come see us after you win, and you can tell us what it feels like.
Well, hopefully we'll get to that point, but if not, it's just going to be an honor to be there anyway.
And
I wanted to just say that the thing that is so wonderful, listeners, about this chef is that he's just big-hearted and vibrant, and you get to know him, and you know you can trust his food. And I think that kind of trust is, you can't buy that.
Well, I appreciate that.
Mike, thanks for joining us on the menu. We'll see you in New York, and again, we got our fingers crossed for a winner.
Well, it's always my pleasure, and thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike. And it's time now to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening, of course, to onthemenuradio.com, and we're delighted to have you with us today. Don't forget that you can email us at any time at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. We just love to hear from you, and often we get news from you that we want to include on our website, and we hope you go there frequently as well to look at all the other resources that we've assembled for you there, including fast-breaking news and other kinds of updates, including some photographs. I just posted a photograph of one of the largest oysters I've ever consumed. Just the kind of useful information that you need if you're with us at On the Menu and interested in the same kinds of things as we are. So there you go. And just in case you forgot, Anne's still here.
I'm here. I didn't even see you take the photo of that oyster. I was eating.
Ah, there you go. Mm. Well, no, I think you'd finished. What I had one huge one left.
Yes.
And I left it on. I photographed it on top of all the other shells, just to show how much larger it was. And I did indeed have. I did indeed cut it into two before I slipped it off the shell. So it was that large, and it was also magnificent. It wasn't just that it was large; it was also absolutely delicious. And we'll be having an interview with Sandy Ingber, the chef and co-owner of the Grand Central Oyster Bar, coming up very soon on the program. In the meantime, On the Menu had the opportunity, while we were in New York, to catch up with two American icons. Well, one's sort of an adopted American, originally from Spain. The other's an American who was adopted by Spain because he grew up there. Andy Nusser at a restaurant called Casamono in New York City, and Jose Andres, who has several restaurants to his name in Washington, D.C., and is involved, very heavily involved in the Spanish cuisine and also bringing Spanish products into the U.S. So their interviews with Anne are pretty self-explanatory, so why don't we just roll them?
On the Menu, as usual, is having a great good time. We're in Manhattan, and we're talking to Chef Andy Nusser, who is, we talked to him before about his cookbook, and now we're sitting in one of his twin restaurants, I guess that's what we'd call it, Casamono, next to Bar Jamon, laughing, eating, having kava, and having a good time. Hello, Andy.
Well, hello to you. Welcome to Casamono, and welcome to New York.
Now, we talked a little bit about your background, but could you just refresh this to our listeners? I mean, how did you end up here cooking Spanish food?
Probably in a very short answer would be, I lived in Spain with my family, and then when we were coming back to the United States, we didn't have enough money to fly back to where we lived, which was California. And actually, our family bought some charter airfare one way from Amsterdam to California. And the charter was all a fraud. And so we were in Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, family of five, with just camping out for 3 days. And finally, KLM, the Royal Dutch Airline, felt sorry for us, bought our airfare, but they would only send us to New York. So the family of five, with $50, landed in New York. And we lived in New York because we were fortunate that we had actually had an aunt and uncle of mine that lived upstate in the Catskills, Ulster County. And so after living in New York for about a year and a half, we finally made it back to California. I finished my high school. And then when I graduated, I flew back to, when I was 18, I bought a bicycle and a one-way ticket to Lisbon. And I rode my bike down through Portugal and into Spain, and then ultimately back to the town that I lived in with my family in 1973. So now it's 1978, 5 years later, going back to the same little village where I washed dishes in a restaurant. So then I go back to California. I have no money. I go to school. I'm working for General Motors.
I cannot picture that one.
10 years go by, and I finally realize, like, okay, this is not right. So what do? I go to school. And I go to school at the CIA, which is in New York. And then when I graduated, I start working in the city. It took a while, but I did do it. I opened up a Spanish restaurant because I wanted it always to represent Spanish food. And I did it in New York because that's where I was living, and that's where I really enjoyed cooking. And it just one day, my mother came in, and we're having lunch here, and I said, this is all your fault, because you're the one that took me to Spain. And this is why I have a Spanish restaurant in New York.
Now, she must be a hoot. Your parents must be wonderful.
They are wonderful. My father passed, but my mother's awesome, and I don't see her frequently enough. She lives very geographically far away, just below Vancouver. So we're in the same climate zone, so we share the same garden secrets, but as far as actually seeing each other, it's not enough. However, I am flying out there in a week with my two kids, so that'll be a happy moment.
Now, explain the setup here. You are not only the chef, but also co-owner with Mario.
With Mario, yes, and Joe Bosianich, and also, yeah, and also Nancy Selzer. And it was coincidentally that Mario actually grew up in Spain as a high school years as well. So it was a shared sort of passion that was set idle. But obviously went quite well to compare our expert, what would you call it, just childhood memories and combine them together to create Casamono.
Couldn't see a better fit. How long has this been in existence?
We are almost 5 years old, so it's as old as my son. When I opened up the restaurant, it was open for a week, and my wife called me and said, come home, and I did. And so that was 4.5 years ago, yeah.
Good timing.
Oh, yeah, you got to do everything at once.
So, okay, explain why we have two separate entrances and I guess there's a shared kitchen in the basement and a, tell, what, explain, describe the setup.
Well, the size of Casamono is very small, but that's not just the hardest thing about Casamono. Casamono is so divided. It's a beautiful venue on a quiet street on Irving Place in 17th Street. The corner place is where the restaurant Casamono is. However, the adjoining bar, which is Bar Jamon, is separated by the entryway to the apartment building that's shared. The prep kitchen is in the basement, and that all of the things that come up and down are in a dumbwaiter. So it's strategically, you know, set up to make you go insane. So, before we took on this venue, a lot of head shaking was going on. It's like, what are you thinking? But, you know, obviously, you know, you just get so accustomed to it that you can't imagine it being in, you know, how any other normal restaurant would be. It does become normal. It does look a little awkward when it's like snowing and then the sommelier is going down into the basement to get the wine. But yeah, I mean, it's an odd setup, but it works.
It's been an absolutely electric setting. Everybody just fell in love with it when it opened. Why do you think that is?
Well, again, I think we're lucky with the neighborhood, the fact that right now it's spring and the doors are open and it's a beautiful day in Manhattan. Of course, I think it's going to be 95 degrees tomorrow, but we won't be saying that. But right now it seems like a very beautiful day. I think we're fortunate to be part of the Spanish food right in the forefront. I mean, obviously there were Spanish restaurants in Manhattan, but they... to use a term, I think we're old school sort of things. So the representation of Spanish food was not done the way that I saw it should be done. That said, my motivation was just traveling and eating in Barcelona or San Sebastian and then coming home and then just putting that food on my menu. You know, but I think Ferran Adrià was on the cover of the New York Times magazine cover on a Sunday issue, and it was an explosion. Not that I really subscribe to molecular gastronomy, which I don't, but, you know, it was just another wonderful, wonderful timing thing. So that combined with also the craze of small plates, where people were dining out and not necessarily wanting to get a huge entree that cost $40, that they could actually order something for $15. And so it was the small plates, the Spanish retroactive explosion that was happening in Manhattan, and then just the fact that we got lucky with this great neighborhood.
Well, it's exciting to be here, and I knew that. I've had reports from everybody about it. Tell us what some of the things we'll be eating tonight.
Well, let's see. Right now we do have the very first jamón ibérico in front of us that we're having with panko tomate and cava mono, our own cava, because we do have Casamono, and I thought how clever it would be to actually have cava mono. So we actually have a delicious sparkling wine that we're having right now. I think what we'll do is we'll order something fried. So we'll have our crispy calamari fritas, maybe some sardinas fritas, fried sardines. But then also we got to get something from the plancha, so maybe some razor clams. Good. And then move into some cephalopods like sepia a la plancha or maybe some pulpo a la plancha. And then take a deep breath and see if we want to move forward. And if we did, then I would think that we should. And then maybe we'll have the guinea hen with rhubarb mostaza or perhaps the sweetbreads al mono or maybe the duck egg with mojama. So I'm very much wanting to cook for you, but I think with the microphone in my mouth, I can't really do it.
Well, I will take away the microphone if that's the issue. Give us quickly a website.
The website is very easy to remember. It's Casamono, NYC, for NewYorkCity.com. And there what it does is it pretty much shares a lot of photographs of the food and of the restaurant, the menu, the wine list, our philosophy, our events that we're involved in doing, and also our little bar next door, Bar Jamon, has the same thing.
Now, Peter wants to add something.
Well, I just thought I might ask you to just talk quickly about the wine program. Spanish wines are loved, abhorred, you know, depending on where you're coming from. Is that something you focus on, and what are some of your favorite regions?
Here I would have to pass the microphone to someone that's not actually sitting here, and that would be my partner, Nancy Selzer. She's the one that actually is in charge of our wine program, and we have actually created something that is unique in the sense that it is so complete, that we cover wine from every region of Spain. I do believe it is the largest wine list of the Spanish variety in the United States. And it is something that I would not even care to pontificate only in that way because it's not my baby. This is something that would be definitely have to be talking with Nancy, and we could more than happy to get her for you.
And is it hard getting a reservation?
It's hard to get in a reservation only in the sense of the size of our restaurant. We are open from 12 to 12, so when you call it, you know, and you want an 8 o'clock and we have a 40-seat restaurant, most likely that's not available. However, there's always cancellations and things happen. There's 14 seats at the bar that we never take reservations for, so you can come in right away and just sit there. But yes, I mean, if you give us some time, which is really hard to do, you know, to plan 2 weeks ahead of time for your reservation, but if you can do that, then yes, we could probably accommodate you.
And can you get me into Co?
Sure.
I'm just joking. Listen, listeners, do come here. It's fun. It's vibrant. The food, from what I've already sampled, is going to be delicious. And this guy's one of the sweethearts of the world. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I just giggle when I'm around Jose Andres. You're such a charmer, Jose.
Well, I mean, listen, what I celebrate is the same things you celebrate, which is good friends, good food, and having great times.
Now, you were a chef, you're Spain-born, near Barcelona-born, you've trained with Ferran Andre, you've how many different restaurants now?
Well, in Washington, D.C., I have 7 restaurants. Jaleo, which is the Spanish restaurant of my childhood kind of foods, Saitinia, Greek, Turkish, Lebanese, Oyamel, my interpretation of Mexican, and Cafe Atlantico, which is my ingredients from Latin America my way, and the one that is closest to my heart, Minibar, where I only do 12 people per night, and is my creative cooking, 30 courses every night.
And you are opening a hotel?
Yeah, opening a hotel, SLS, in L.A., in Beverly Hills. And this is my first time away from the Washington metropolitan area, but I think I'm joining the right kind of people. Philippe Stark, design restaurant. Sam Nazarian is the owner, my partner, a very young guy, very bright. And I think we're going to do a hotel that is going to be very unique because it's going to be very fun.
We're going to be there. Now, you've done something else remarkable. You have stopped the traffic of Spanish hams in people's suitcases. Tell us about your jamón project.
Well, let me tell you what happened. I mean, America is a great country because they celebrate ingredients and ethnic gastronomic influences from any country around the world like no other country. So I am a Spanish chef, and my little contribution, if I can say so, to America has been trying to bring those ingredients that I know are great for my country, but that for some reason they never made it into America. When I arrived 15 years ago, to find good Spanish ingredients was very much mission impossible. So I can tell you that I am as good as the team that I have working with me, but also as a chef, I can tell you that I am as good as the ingredients I have next to me. Yes, many ingredients are local. Many ingredients are from farmers I know. But many ingredients, if I want to do real Spanish cooking, they have to be coming from Spain. Anchovies, olive oil, piquillo peppers. But Iberico is the Rolls Royce of Spanish cooking. Why? There's no other cure ham product like it in the world. And what I did only was create the spark that will convince one small producer to do the right investment, to be able to homologate his slaughterhouse. So after 5-6 years, finally, a few months ago, we were able to get the first Iberico ham in the States.
People are stomping up and down on the tables. They're so thrilled. How does an ordinary person get this ham?
Well, slowly, the ham is going to be available more and more around different places around the country. You know, it's going to be specialty stores. This is not going to be mainstream. It doesn't try to be. But the truth is that what we need to understand that the Iberico ham is going to be expensive. For a little plate, people are going to be paying $20, $30, $40. But, you know, when people tell me, Jose, this is expensive. You see, all in life is relative. I don't smoke cigarettes. And when I see people that will pay $5 and $6 for cigarettes, I will tell them, man, that's expensive. This is doing harm to you. And on top of that, you have to pay for it. I mean, you see, the value of things is relative to what you compare it with.
Now, do you have like a website people can go to?
It's funny. I am involved. I am in the company that imports this. It's called Rogers International. But, you know, we don't, the company directly doesn't sell retail. But yes, I can tell you two web pages that people can find Iberico and many other Spanish products without a problem. One will be tienda.com, the great Harris family, that they are the Americans with the biggest Spanish heart. Tienda, T-I-E-N-D-A.com.
Yeah, it's actually, we're linked to them. Our website is so that you can go to www.onthemenuradio.com and click on La Tienda, and you got it.
So, and then it's other people in the West Coast also that I think they have also a webpage called the SpanishTable.com. So every day is more and more places that are selling online. But also, what can I tell you? I can go to many stores, and, you know, you have to see my face with a big smile ear to ear when I see that now is 10 or 15 different kinds of olive oils from Spain. Piquillo peppers, anchovies, tuna in olive oil, the Iberico ham. I mean, what can I tell you? I'm in a moment of celebration because I see my country every day has a slightly bigger space in the hearts of many people in this great country.
And it's also the largest olive oil producer. And what about those wonderful almonds?
Hold on. Can I correct you here? We're not the biggest producer of olive oil.
Grower.
We are the biggest producer, but first I want to say we are the best olive oil. And then happens that we are the biggest. So, you know, I don't want to start a fight with my great Italian friends that I enjoy so much. Sorry, Mario, and so many others. But, you know, they know, poor guys, even if it says Italy, hey, the oil is coming from Spain. That's okay. This is a truth. Don't worry. We can live with it. We will support you forever. Italian food is amazing, but the olive oil. Well, it's my wife, who's here next to us, Patricia. She's from the south of Spain, from Andalucía. And Andalucía is the kingdom of olive oil, period. And you know, it's amazing to see how olive oil, really, we use it for so many things. And by the way, I never understood the French fries. If someone fries, that's Spain. So the fries, they should be called Spanish fries, period. Sorry, I'm not in a political campaign. I'm only setting the record straight.
Thank you so much. Bye. And don't forget to watch your show. How do they hear your show?
Well, my show is on public television. I cannot believe I'm in the same stations where the great Jack Pepin and the great Julia Child, they've been my heroes. So you can watch me in your local public television, PBS, Made in Spain, where we not only will cook with Spanish ingredients that you can find in America, but I will keep taking you back to Spain to show you where everything comes from.
Love it.
So now you know where you can dine Spanish style in New York and in Washington, D.C., and more about some of the wonderful ingredients that are available from the Iberian Peninsula that Jose and other people are bringing to us. But I think now it's time to, as Anne would say, take a pause for the cause, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu, and we're going to take you now from Spain to Madison Square Park in Manhattan for the biggest barbecue in 97 degree temperature we've ever been to, and wasn't that fun? Everybody turned out.
Yeah, there we are on the menu, partying with 125,000 of our very best friends, and we just couldn't cover everyone there, but we picked the barbecue stand that seemed like it was the most representative. It also had the biggest crowd, and when Danny Meyer was walking around, he came over there and talked to us as well, so I think he knew it was a good place to stop.
He said, you know where to stop, yeah. So, he has his own stand Blue Smoke.
So there we are. So we're talking to Gary Roark, whose family business is Udons, and here's
Udons.
A story.
Udons.
Did I get it wrong? Udons. Yeah. Well, it's only five letters. I'll be sure to get it wrong.
I wonder what that means.
The names are complicated, but the food is simple, simply magnificent. We're at the Snapple Big Apple Block Barbecue Party, and talking to Gary Roark, who's from Ubons.
So great. You pronounced everything just right. That's amazing. That's amazing. Ubons. I love it.
And Ubons came all the way from Yazoo City, Mississippi, 50 miles from the state capital of Jackson, to be here at Madison Park for this weekend. How come, Gary?
I think because we have barbecue, we'll travel, and this is such a fine outing for it's a good way to meet people. It's an excellent opportunity to help raise money for Madison Square Park. The rewards are just amazing. Even though it's a lot of miles, we feel like the rewards are amazing because the people are just the friends that we made through our travels. It's amazing. That's where the rewards are.
Now, how did you get you brought your entire rig here? Do you tow it on the back of a trailer?
Yes, we have a trailer. It took us approximately 23 hours to get here. We took it slow. We're getting older, so we don't want to drive when we're tired. So we put in a 10 or 12 hour day and we stop and cool our jets and then we get up and go the next day.
So what's cooking here is absolutely authentic the way it would be in Yazoo City?
Oh yes, we wouldn't want to serve anything that, would be below average, below par. So we want everything. I mean, every time we cook, regardless of who we're cooking for, it's got to be the Ubon standards. And, that's why I think we're invited here, because we want everybody to enjoy the same type barbecue that we enjoy in Mississippi.
No, I meant to say it's identical because you're using the identical equipment. Are you using the identical pigs too?
We're using the identical equipment, the same smokers. We even brought our own wood. We use a pecan and, or as they say in New York, pecan, but we use pecan and hickory for our smoke flavor, and we do them slow and low, just like we do at home. The identical cooking situation here, just like we would do if we were cooking for 50 people in our backyard.
And the cooking time from start to finish is about how long?
We're looking at about a 12 to 15 hour turnaround on our bus. Now we're able to cook about yesterday we did a little over 200 Boston butts to get us through the day, and then last night we loaded the cookers up again so that we'd be ready for an additional 200 butts today.
And if people go to Yazoo City, Mississippi, though, you have a restaurant also, so they can go there?
Right, we have a restaurant. We're located on Jerry Clower Boulevard, of all things. You know, that's Jerry Clower country, Yazoo City is. And we're located on Jerry Clower Boulevard in Yazoo City, right in the heart of Mississippi.
Now, there are different styles of barbecue sourcing that we've read about. How would you describe yours?
Well, ours is a traditional, what we call a Memphis-style type barbecue sauce. It's a tomato base. It's got the right amount of sweet, the vinegar, the sweet, the sour is there, a little bit of hot, not much, but traditionally a Memphis-style, southern-type barbecue sauce.
And somebody in your family invented it, right?
Well, this is five generations old. This was first done by my grandparents. My grandfather was a farmer in southeast Missouri, and he would mix this sauce up one time a year in a big number three tub, stir it with a boat paddle that he probably fished with the day before, and he would cook a whole hog or a side of beef and get all the neighbors over. And he did this every 4th of July. It was just a traditional thing that he did. And I think from that, my daddy and I have gone on from that to where we are now.
There's an interesting guy just here. I'm not sure if he'll have a second to say hello in just a minute. This is sort of like his party, so let me ask you another question while we get Danny Meyer over here. What do you drink with barbecue, Gary?
I think it's strictly optional. Anything cold, preferably. I love a glass of sweet iced tea with lemon in it. That's my favorite drink for barbecue because usually it's hot when we're doing this, and that's the most refreshing thing. Of course, a lot of folks say you can't go wrong with a cold beer.
Well, now here's sort of our host for the day, Danny Meyer. Danny, say hi.
I can just say that you made a darn good choice to interview Mr. Gary right here, because it doesn't get much better. As a matter of fact, my daughter here, who's a real connoisseur of barbecue, said, "Where do I go?" And I said, "We're going to Ubon's right now."
I think I'm having pulled pork. I'm not Ubon's. Sure what the... Yeah.
That's what Daddy promised her.
Yeah.
His character down here.
His name is Peyton.
Hi.
What's your name?
Peyton.
Oh, wow. Okay, you're going to have some too. I'm going to have some of my dad's.
You're going to have some of your dad's. Okay,
Dad. We don't want them to run out for all the big fans here, so we're going to make two sandwiches go three ways, and that'll be good. You know, when you got 14 pitmasters, you got to save a little room in your gullet. I do have a separate stomach just for barbecue, but even it doesn't make it past about 9 pitmasters.
Well, Danny, undoubtedly, we'll see you later. Thank you so much for joining us. Gary, say goodbye and come on down or something like that.
Goodbye. If you're in the South, come see us. We're at Yazoo City. We'd love to meet you. Love to talk to you.
And you have a website?
Ubonds.net. If you'd like to contact somebody there, Leslie@Ubonds.net. She checks her email every day, unlike her daddy.
That's your daughter.
That's my daughter.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to us. It was a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's mine.
Just to be clear, that's Ubonds, U-B-O-N-S. We kept going back and forth over that. It was some wonderful, big, sweltering block party is what it was, and we were drinking Schnapple. But there was something else we could drink, not there, of course, but at some other big event. You want to listen to this author who has a book out called 101 Sangrias. And she also has other pitcher drinks, which is a great way for sating the thirst of crowds.
And in fact, as I recall, she said it's 101 sangrias and pitcher drinks. So there aren't 101 sangrias. Otherwise, we might have to run for the hills.
Yeah, well, she may be saying that now. Why don't we just listen to what she said?
She also does a good job in pointing out that sangria really can be a wonderful beverage, just as a bad one can be a despicable one. So here she is.
Kim Hasserud. I hope I got that one right. It's a pretty on paper, the Haasarud.
That's right.
Yeah, it's really pretty.
Norwegian.
Oh, is that what it is? Oh, great.
Yeah, I married, my last name before that was Murray.
Murray.
I went from a pretty simple last name to something that was going to be misspelled, mispronounced all the time. My husband said, "Are you sure you want to do that?" I'm like, "Yes."
You start out spelling it out, right?
Right.
We're the only place that our name is pronounced correctly is in England, because it's north of England.
It's in my. The same thing would probably happen to. Perhaps it has happened to you when you've gone back to your husband's hometown in Norway, and automatically you spell your last name out because you know no one will be able to pronounce it. And I was at a store in my hometown with our son, who like me got into the habit of spelling out his last name, and then he said, but the shop assistant knew exactly how it was spelled. So I said, let me show you a phone book. Because there are 500 Hagues in the phone book in a town of 100,000 people. You'll probably find the same thing back in Norway.
I'm sure.
Kim is the founder of Liquid Architecture, which is a beverage consulting firm. And Kim, you create specialty cocktails for clients and such as restaurants, hotels, liquor companies. You've been paired to Alice Waters, Wolfgang Puck for your specialty drinks, and you've written 101 Martinis, 101 Margaritas, and now 101 Sangrias. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I started as a bartender in New York. Well, I've worked in food and beverage since graduating high school, but I lived in New York City for about 10 years, which is really where I started to kind of gain my bartending craft. Uh-huh. And moved to Los Angeles and started this consultancy where I initially worked for a lot of the movie studios in creating some signature cocktails, and eventually segued and started working directly with a lot of hotel chains and restaurant groups, as well as a lot of liquor brands, bringing a culinary aspect to creating cocktails, which includes, you know, using a lot of fresh ingredients and premium spirits, and just really raising the bar.
Now, do you work in the same way as a sommelier might do in sort of recommending one cocktail versus another, or is it different than that?
In some regard, I mean, in a best case scenario, I try to get the dialogue going between, you know, the bar staff and the kitchen, to really utilize some of those same ingredients so they can, you know, work off each other. So you're not, you know, bringing in new ingredients to create new drinks, but you're kind of utilizing some of those same things.
Yeah, well, this is what's new about the new cocktail, isn't it? I mean, they're called bar chefs, as well as mixologists now?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, the whole industry is, it's a really exciting time to be working in this industry.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're right there. You're right there at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm so excited to be kind of doing what I'm doing right now. It's, cause people are really open to it. And, you know, before I think people were bartenders just as a way to kind of get through college. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, you know, people are really pursuing this as a career. So
they're rock stars.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Let's turn our attention to this 101 sangrias. I mean, I never thought you could get 101 of this classic. How do you?
Right.
Yeah. It is classic. Tell us what makes a good sangria.
You know, a great sangria, there's, you really need a pretty good wine. And a pretty good wine, like about in the $10 range. You don't want to use a really expensive wine. You know, part of what makes a really fancy, good wine is a lot of the subtleties. But if you start to kind of mix that with other spirits and fruit, you're going to lose some of those subtleties. So you don't want to use a really expensive wine.
No, is there a...
But you also... You also don't want to use a really cheap wine either. You don't want to use a wine that you wouldn't normally have a glass of.
Is there a particular grape variety that you think is particularly adept? I mean, it's a Spanish drink, so should people be looking for a Tempranillo from Rioja, or do they not need to be that particular?
I think, you know, the traditional is a Spanish red wine, a Rioja, or you can even use a Shiraz. You know, I experimented with a lot of different wines here, and I used everything from Cabernets to Merlots to Burgundies, and they were all pretty good. You really want to use a hearty wine that can stand up to the other fruits and spirits that you're going to use. You know, I did try using some of the more delicate red wines, like a Pinot Noir, and they weren't really as successful just because it couldn't really hold up to the fruit. But I found that the best wines were like a nice Shiraz or a Cabernet or a Rioja were really good.
Now, if there are 101 of them, they must be categorized in some way. Can you explain how you categorize them in the book?
Sure. I started off with the red sangrias, kind of the more traditional. I have a Spanish sangria. And then I started to kind of do variations from that. And I end with some really kind of light and exotic white sangrias. Like I have a white sangria made with a plum wine and a sake. And so I kind of get, you know, use a lot of different spirits.
Yeah,
but
some of this is not really.
Book,
yeah, I would think that you'd question whether this macadamia nut brulee is really a sangria.
No, well, the book is full. It's 101 sangrias and pitcher drinks.
Oh, and pitcher
okay,
drinks.
Yes, okay,
right.
Yes.
Right, so I start with sangrias, and then I go to some drinks like punches and drinks that you can serve kind of in a pitcher.
And perfect for parties in the summertime.
Exactly. But you know, in the book, I really encourage people to use the recipes as a guideline. You know, as a mixologist, I'm very careful about the quantities I use in a cocktail. If something calls for, you know, 3/4 ounce of this or 1/2 ounce of that, I'm very specific. But a sangria kind of breaks those rules. You can kind of approach it like cooking, you know, do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So I encourage people to use the book as a guideline and really be creative with it. A lot of my inspiration from the book just came from going to my local farmer's market and finding some, you know, great fruit and seasonal ingredients that looked really ripe and were great and kind of built the sangria around that.
Yeah, this looks good. The pomegranate agave sangria, very contemporary.
Right, yeah, I used, that one's actually a tequila-based. So, yeah, I really kind of run the gamut with all kinds of different spirits. In a typical sangria, you know, you want to use a brandy or some kind of an orange liqueur, but I really go a little crazy and use everything from vodkas to tequilas to sake.
Now, is sangria a cocktail drink, or is it a drink that goes with meals, or is it both?
It's great pairing with meals, especially the red sangrias, like, you know, are great with hamburgers, are great with grilled meats. You know, they're really, you know, fruity, but it's got layers of complexity in it that I find it really works well with, like, those grilled meats, kind of summertime barbecues.
Well, the photographs are wonderful, and they really look terrific. They're beautiful to look at, these cocktails.
Yeah, oh, thanks so much. You know, one... another key element in making a great sangria is, you know, they're really nice to serve in those nice glass pitchers, and you can be really creative in the ways you cut the fruit. For example, with citrus fruits, it's nice if you want to kind of cut them into wheels, because it really shows up really nicely on the glass pitcher. Or if you're using fresh pineapple, you can actually get some cookie cutters and, you know, cut them into stars for a great, you know, 4th of July sangria.
Well, they're lovely. What's next, Kim? I mean, you've done the martinis and the margaritas. What's next?
I have 101 champagne cocktails coming out at the end of the year.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. So did you include the French 76 or whatever it was?
French 75, I sure did. 75, I included a lot of, you know, classics, like the classic champagne cocktail, the French 75.
My mother used to serve that. For
parties. Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the French 75.
You remember the wonderful, when we made strawberry champagne cocktails, and you were wearing your wonderful dress, and one of the guest children decided he would experiment with the fruit, and it finished up on Anne's dress, which was never again wearable because it had a stain all over it.
He threw up on my dress. It was really lovely.
So they
weren't even invited to this party.
Included in your champagne cocktail recipe, please include instructions for removing stains.
And was he ever invited back?
No, they went back. They were living in the south of France, and they were just passing through. They went back to the south of France, and not to be heard from since.
I thought they were in Algeria or Timbuktu or somewhere like Timbuktu. No, Timbuktu is not in the south of France, dear. Timbuktu's in the middle of West Africa.
Well, then they went to Timbuktu.
You're going to have to be geographically reoriented here.
I don't really believe that.
But sangria is in your view, is a not just a Spanish specialty. I mean, it's a worldwide drink.
Worldwide drink, but that can be enjoyed by anyone, and it really can allow you to be creative as you want to be.
Okay, now here's your website. You want to give it to us?
Sure. It's www.liquid-architecture.com.
Great. That's a hyphen, isn't it?
Little hyphen.
Okay, very good. And on your website, what else can people find?
I've got some recipes for a black cherry martini. I've got some other champagne cocktails. I think I have one for a creme brulee martini. I'm actually going to be it needs to be updated, so I'm going to be including a lot more recipes on there.
Oh, good. Well, listeners, check out the book, which is on our website. You can order it right off there. And check out the Kim's website of Liquid Architecture and get fresh recipes from that. And Kim, thank you for talking to us, and would you let us know when your champagne book's out?
I sure will.
Great. Have a wonderful day.
Okay, you too. Thank you so much.
Bye. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu, and may I give you our email address one more time? It's onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
And also, of course, our website with all the other resources we've assembled for you, www.onthemenuradio.com.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they're listening to it, they obviously already know that.
Yeah, but they may not have looked at all the favorite stuff and all the
that's true.
All the wonderful
pictures.
There is
more to it that people like it.
There's just a whole lot of stuff there, and
and now this next guest, since we're in this drinking mood here, is somebody that Peter selected, this author in this book, noting that he thought it sounded interesting, and it certainly was.
Gary Vaynerchuk, otherwise known as the Wine something or other here. He has a daily TV broadcast over the internet all about wine. Gary's a man on a mission. He knows a lot about the business. He's been in the business a long time, and he's really contributed, I think, to demystifying wine. So those of you who don't know a lot about wine will find him very interesting. Those of you who know a lot about wine will find him very controversial, but we hope you'll be interested in his rather strongly worded opinions.
How to explain Gary Vaynerchuk, our next guest on the menu. I think it's probably fair to say he's a reverse wine snob. meant in the very best possible way. Gary.
And cute too.
How do you know that? You know about him. He's on the end of a phone line.
I like the compliments. Keep them coming.
Okay. My wife's interrupting my train of thought here, which is a very unusual thing to happen. How come you decided to get into the wine business in the way that you did? That's a good place to start.
Well, you know, I was born in Belarus, the former Soviet Union, and my family and I immigrated into the States in the late 70s. And, you know, Dad, you know, we lived in a studio apartment with 8 or 9 relatives, and, you know, Dad had to get a job somewhere, and he got a job as a liquor store as a stock boy, and, you know, did a good job and became assistant manager, and then became manager, and then became part owner, and, you know, he's my hero. He did an amazing job. I always tell my dad, I'm going to become a billionaire and buy the New York Jets, but what you accomplished in the first 5 years in America with no language and no money is still going to be bigger than what I did.
And
go ahead.
And you've been working there in this business yourself, you said, for 10 years?
Well, actually, I started in 1994, 1991, 92, when I was in high school, coming on the weekends, making ice and, you know, packing bags and, really got involved my junior and senior year of high school, started realizing people collected wine. And I was very much running a very successful baseball card business at the time. And once I saw that connection that there was collecting in wine like there was in baseball cards, that became a very big hook for me because, of course, you know, being with my family is very important to me, and this gave me an opportunity to kind of scratch 2 itches. And so I started learning and reading quite a bit about wine, and in 1998 took over full-time operations. We changed the name of the store from Shoppers Discount Liquors to Wine Library. And course of the next 7 years, we built one of the largest independent wine retailers in the country.
And you've also got a wine bar, and you said something very interesting about who's coming.
Well, you mean the millennials, the 21 to 30?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. We don't have a wine bar, but we do
tastings. Oh, you don't? Oh, so you do you just do tastings in the store?
We do. But, yeah, no question, there's an enormous explosion of interest. You know, 10 years ago, I was desperate to get 21 to 25-year-olds into wine. I was that age. I really wanted my friends and my neighbors and people I knew in that age bracket to get into wine, and there just wasn't an interest. And I think over the last couple of years with Sideways, Two Buck Chuck, and the Internet as a whole, we've seen an enormous explosion in wine interest in that demo. And, you know, Wine Library TV, I'm sure, you know, now that we're going into our third year, definitely has an impact on it as well, because I think a lot of people in that demo are a little bit more accustomed and comfortable with watching a 25-minute show on the Internet. And, you know, I'm proud of that.
Yeah, what a funny sense of humor you have, too. My, what a big pinot you have.
Oh, dear.
Yeah,
keep the FCC off our back, please, Mrs. Haig. Anyway, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you're a sort of a reverse wine snob. You talk about Robert Parker, and you say that he has a lot of influence, and you give him a lot of credit, but at the same time, you take on him and Wine Spectator, and you say, in a sense, they're doing a disservice to the wine public.
Well, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't say that I think they're doing a disservice to the wine public. I think the wine public's doing a disservice to itself by giving the credit to an individual's palate that may not need to be deserved. I mean, for example, I have a lot of followers. 80,000 people a day watch Wine Library TV, and every third day I'm yelling and screaming to them to not listen to my palate, to not listen or trust what I'm saying, to listen and trust themselves. And the biggest message of Wine Library TV is to try different things. You know, go and explore. I mean, you know, Cab, Shiraz, Merlot, Pinot Grigio, everybody has those. But I think it's time people explore these wondrous grapes that are out there that nobody knows anything about.
Now, what you did, and the reason you're on the program, is you just published a book called 101 Wines Guaranteed to Inspire, Delight, and Bring Thunder to Your World. And it's sort of, it's the equivalent in the wine business, I guess, of what Adam Platt did when he categorized all the New York restaurants and put them in 5-star down to 1-star or no stars, and really set the world on its ear. And you've done the same thing by saying, I'm bold enough to say, here are 101 wines I like. I'm going to rank them all the way from 101 down to my very favorite, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to offer it to you to try. And, why did you decide to do it that way?
A couple reasons. I think that, you know, my main rationale for starting Wine Library TV a couple years ago was that I felt that, I was very much at the top of the retail industry. We had very high-level clientele. I was receiving, you know, hundreds of emails a day doing business. I went to all the tastings, and I very much had a sense that wine was put into a status that it didn't want to in our society. Being a very young country as America is, I think we're still intimidated and don't have the wine self-esteem that maybe some of the old world countries have. And I felt like people were overthinking it. And you know what really hit me? When 30 straight conversations I had with people out there started with, "I'm sorry. Gary, I'm sorry I only drink white Zinfandel. I'm sorry I only like sweet wines. I'm sorry I only like white wines." I didn't understand why people felt they were sorry. Nobody ever told me, "I'm sorry I only like cheeseburgers," or "I'm sorry I love vegetables." You know? And so I went on a mental mission to, you know, create a new thought process in the wine industry. And so that was really the agenda of starting this show. Now, to fully start a movement and get people thinking in a different way, you've got to be in every platform you can. And being on the internet on a video show is still a small platform. And obviously writing a book is going to reach an enormous demo that would have not normally maybe found my show. And that was definitely by far the biggest catalyst. That, and I wanted my mom to run around town saying her son was an author.
There you go. So I think it's a great idea. I think I agree with you completely. Americans are intimidated. Until we joined a wine tasting group here in Pittsburgh, that were great Francophiles. Candidly, mm-hmm. I fancy I know a little bit about wine, but I was always put off by the naming system in France that didn't tell you what grape it was. You had to understand what region it was from. And I still find that a little bit intimidating, but less so as a result of the experience of having drunk with some people who are real experts all the way through all the regions of France, white and red. I felt that I learned a lot from that. And what you're doing here, I think, is helping people enormously to have the opportunity to try their palate against a set of wines that are readily available that won't set them back large amounts of money. And that will set them on the road to saying, "Well, I don't necessarily agree with Gary on this one, but at least they have the basis for saying, here's my 101 favorite wines or my 10 favorite wines or whatever it is."
Exactly. And you know what? Because of, you know, the national exposure I've gotten through being on Conan and Ellen and Nightline and, you know, Mad Money and, you know, New York Times and Wall Street Journal, I've gotten a lot of press, and I feel like I have a duty to talk about wines that are maybe a little bit outside the box, but most importantly, very true to me.
You know, talk about some in the box, which I think is also brave.
You know, and I think that was a very fun thing for me. I tasted 40 different boxed wines in hopes that something would tickle me. And one wine from Bordeaux did that. You know, it was a very special little wine. And, you know, I felt like that was a big, you know, exciting thing for me. I feel like I'm proud that my first book that has my 50 wines that I love, you know, right there, number 50 is a Bordeaux. Now, 2005 was a very special vintage, and that probably helped the quality of that box wine. But I'm also extremely proud that there's an Asti Spumante, because there are great Asti Spumantes being made. And I'm proud that there's a wine from Lebanon and Israel. I don't think people really realize how many great wines from around the world there really are. And let's not forget, only 30 years ago, California wine was being looked down on. I mean, 10 years ago, nobody was talking about any New Zealand wines. They didn't exist in the U.S.
Yeah, we interviewed that Judgment in Paris guy.
That's right.
Who also wrote a book called To Cork or Not To Cork, which is another
George
issue.
George Tabor. Do you know George?
Right. I do. As a matter of fact, we're going to be I'm going to be the wine wizard in Houston this upcoming week, for the whole week, for the Houston Wine Festival, and he's on my wizard court. So yes, I do.
Yeah, he's a really good guy. We really enjoyed talking to him. And
I'm glad.
We actually met Warren Winarski when he was in Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh Wine Festival the first two or three years he was here. And the only thing that was difficult was that he was totally surrounded by an adoring audience, which is really rather annoying. And I don't think he was very comfortable. I don't think he was very comfortable with it. You wonder what lies behind the fact that he just decided to sell out. I mean, maybe he just had enough of fame and he wants to go off and start over again.
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's where George and I are very different. I'm more than thrilled to have an adoring audience around me.
No, I was talking about Warren Winarski from Stag's Leap.
Oh, yes. Oh.
And, his wine is good. Is it that good? Is it that much better than other wines?
I promise. You know what it is? It's Americana. It's a very fine wine, and there's plenty of wines that are better and the same. But the difference Stag's Leap had was that it is a very good brand. And we live in a brand society, my friend.
You
look at every car in this country has a logo on it. 90% of the clothes people are wearing have logos on it. Every shoe does. And he had brand, and he obviously got offered money that he couldn't say no to.
Now, the 101 wines that you have, most of them are in the relatively inexpensive category?
I think they range. You know, the one thing, I've been getting some emails from fans saying that the wines were more expensive than they expected, actually, but that's because I had to put suggested retail pricing. And obviously, I think we all know, America, again, that most wines are going to be 20, 30% less on the shelf. For example, my number three
not
wine.
Not in Pennsylvania.
Well, I know. I grew up in Hunterdon County, New Jersey, right? A hop and a skip away from Lehigh Valley. So
yeah, with everybody coming over to buy, right?
That's right.
Everybody coming over loading up.
That's right. So the number three wine, you know, the Louis Philippe Edwards, which is a Sauvignon Blanc from Chile, which, by the way, as a side note, I think that Chile is going to be known for its Pinot Noirs and Sauvignon Blanc 5 years from now, much more than anything else. You know, it's listed as a $14 wine. In essence, most stores around the country are selling it for $9 and $10.
I'm looking at a Chateauneuf du Pape for $50.
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, like, for example, that wine's $36 in our shop and probably the same with the most competitive stores around the country. And so, you know, I what was very important to me when I sat down and decided to do this list? Not to have any preconceived judgments. Exactly what I preach and yell. My mom did an amazing job raising me and making me look at every human being on an individual basis. I think that's translated into how I look at wine. It's why I think I'm anti-cultural, because I don't want to think that Bordeaux is better than, you know, Romania. I want to take every wine on its individual basis. There was a lot of humbling experiences. For example, I yell and scream that champagne is the most, you know, problematic category in the U.S. because we're not drinking the best champagnes. We're drinking brands like Moët and Clicquot and Perrier-Jouët. And I make fun of Dom Perignon quite often on Wine Library TV, yet Dom P is number 13 on the list because for this book I got to taste the new vintage, which was the 99, and I tasted it, and I was blown away. And I promise you, I had to grind my teeth to add it to the list because I knew a lot of my fan base would be completely stunned to see it there because I've taken at least 6 to 10 shots at the brand in the last 2 years. And so I'm very proud that I'm able to kind of, you know, swallow my pride and do that. At the same token, that's the rationale behind having wines from all over the place. I'm sure as you got to look at the list, I mean, I've gotten thousands of emails from people in the trade that are just flabbergasted at the direction of the list.
Yeah, I'm going to do one thing. I don't want to steal the thunder. I want people to buy this book because I want them. I want you to be encouraged to do another one after this as well, because I think you're doing a wonderful job. But last question for you before we sign off. Regardless of price, your favorite white and your favorite red wine that's currently in distribution that people would be able to buy if they came to a store like yours.
Sure. So, you know, keeping in mind having some sort of distribution, I'm not going to go very specific because it's not what I believe in wines, but I'm going to tell you something that I would love to see. I would love to see the listeners of your fabulous show go out and try an Italian white wine that doesn't say Pinot Grigio on it. I am extremely passionate at the quality-price ratio we're seeing from Greco di Tufo, from Falanghina, from Fiano, from Ribolla Gialla. These are amazing $12 to $13 wines that are crisp, clean, and perfect for the summer. On the red side, that is the easiest question I'm going to get in a long time. Portugal is, in my opinion, the holy grail, the hidden gem in the world right now for quality red wines. You can get wines between $8 and $15 from Portugal, from the Douro region, D-O-U-R-O. A fellow Pennsylvanian by the name of Mark Squires, I know, is very passionate about Portugal as well, and who writes for Robert Parker's Wine Advocate now, as a matter of fact. And I'm blown away. I mean, I've had a $5 or $6 wine recently from Portugal. With the euro kicking the dollar's face in, I have no idea what they're paying their labor over there. I don't know how the wine comes in so inexpensive, but the quality's immense, and I think there's a 3 to 4 year window before Portugal really explodes on the scene like Australia and Spain did, where you can really find some value.
Great. Well, Peter's sitting here with the thumbs up.
Yeah, the daily video program on the internet is at www.winelibrary.com.
Winelibrary.com is the retail side. WineLibraryTV.com.
Oh, WineLibraryTV. Thank you very much. So can you also buy online from WineLibrary.com?
You can, depending, you know, of course, all the archaic laws of the state. But, you know, I'll be very honest with you. That was the first part of my career. I'm onto something different now. I could care less if anybody bought a single bottle from Wine Library or a single bottle from this book. What I am completely driven on now is changing the culture and the mindset of the wine-drinking public in our country and making them realize it's about people, bringing family together and enjoying different kinds of wines. And that's what I'm going to run through a brick wall for.
Well, you're wonderful.
Yeah,
I'm so glad we've caught on to you.
Yeah, way to go, Gary. We're so delighted you were part of the program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, guys, and I wish you nothing but the best, and I hope we cross paths and get to share a little wine.
Oh, I hope so, too.
Bye for now.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, Gary.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that about does it for On the Menu for another week, and stay with us next time.
Yeah, we were having so much fun, we ran over again.
Did we?
Yeah, but that's okay.
Well, anyhow, listeners, join us next week, same time.
Same place.
Until then, bye-bye.